Hey, so how you feeling? I mean, you know, financially. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizzo. It is Tuesday, today the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I will begin today by pointing out that you don't actually have to check the value of your 401k every day. And you don't actually have to Zillow your house. What, maybe every couple of weeks? I mean, we do, of course, because we can't help ourselves. And when things are good and values and prices and portfolios are growing reasonably, we feel pretty good. There's a word for that, actually, among economic professionals. It's called the wealth effect, that when our assets go up, we spend more money because we feel better about our finances. But what happens, do you suppose, when those assets decline in value? Like, oh, now? Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us started.
Nate Esther has lots of tabs open during work. Email, Twitter, some news sites, and his 401k.
And that's a tab that I just ritually open every morning, and it's there, and I could check it embarrassingly, I don't know, 100 times a day.
Esther is no day trader on the verge of retirement. He's a 40-year-old electrical engineer in Denver. And back in 2020 and 2021, that tab was usually instant dopamine.
You know, it's like getting a like on a post on Facebook or Instagram.
But this year?
It's more just of an emotional downer and then a feeling of like, I have no control over this.
Feeling less wealthy makes you less likely to spend money, says Stephanie Tully at USC Marshall School of Business. And her research suggests feeling pinched also shifts spending from services to goods, even frivolous goods.
People's propensity to buy things like a revolving tie rack or a heated toilet seat, those become more attractive relative to experiences such as going out to eat when you feel financially constrained.
You know the old saying, a heated toilet seat will last you years, a steak dinner will last you not as long as a heated toilet seat. The stock market has tanked much harder than housing prices, but a decline in home values could also impact consumption. Economist Adam Gurin at Boston University says the refi piggy bank is more expensive to tap now.
If you're trading in a 3% mortgage for a 6% mortgage, your monthly payment is going to go way up. And that's going to limit the extent to which people want to spend out of their home equity.
Of course, this is what Jay Powell wants. Skip the steak dinner and the heated toilet seat to fight inflation. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
More perhaps than you wanted to know about heated toilet seats. I don't know. On Wall Street today, really good, then not so good, then flat-ish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the Marketplace desk of, holy cow, the American housing market, this item today, the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index came out this morning. Nationally, home prices were up almost 16% for the year ended in July, which is a lot. But, and here's the news, that is quite a bit less than the better than 18% annual increase in June. A forceful deceleration is what Case-Shiller called it. So, home prices still going up, just less so. Meanwhile, researchers at the San Francisco Fed say all that working from home might account for more than half of real estate price increases over the course of the pandemic. And that includes rents, too, by the way. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on that one.
At the start of the pandemic, Kim Kadena lived in a 700-square-foot rental in Alexandria, Virginia, where they work as a housing analyst for the city.
It was one of those open floor plan apartments, so one room that was the living room, dining room, and, you know, a little galley kitchen where you could, like, see into the whole place, and then a separate bedroom.
When Kadena started working from home in 2020, that bedroom started to feel like their only escape from work. So this August, Kadena moved to a bigger place.
It has a separate den, so I can separate the workspace from the rest of my life.
But they now pay $2,000 a month, $335 more than before. Demand for newer, bigger housing options has grown during the pandemic. Researchers at the San Francisco Fed and UC San Diego say the move to remote work was an important factor in the 24% rise in home prices between November 2019 and November 2021. Johannes Wieland of UC San Diego worked on the Fed's research.
Our work suggests that housing demand is going to remain elevated relative to where it was before the pandemic.
There's now plenty of evidence that housing and other causes of inflation are not as transitory as Fed policymakers once thought they were, says Meg Jacobs, a senior research scholar at Princeton.
Those situations have taken longer to resolve. The Fed feels that it has to act.
But Jacobs says it's not clear that hiking interest rates will affect what she calls structural changes in this new economy, chief among them housing and the transition so many have made to working from home. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
We're exactly 42 days from the midterm elections, which means we are smack in the middle of busy season for polling companies. And in that polling world, Gallup is one of the big names. It's known mostly for things like presidential approval ratings and how Americans feel about this issue or that. But Gallup also tracks things like food insecurity and workplace engagement. And since 2006, how happy we are. The CEO of Gallup, John Clifton, has a book out about that. It's called Blind Spot, The Global Rise of Unhappiness and How Leaders Missed It. And when we talked the other day, I asked Mr. Clifton why, first of all, we are so unhappy.
It really comes down to three factors. One of them is the global rise of hunger. The other two big factors are loneliness and the workplace. We spend so much of our lives at work. There's one analysis that says it's 115,000 hours, which is 13 years of a person's life. I tried to replicate the analysis and came up with about 85,000. So the only thing we do more in life is sleep. So if we spend that much time at work, if we are truly miserable at work, it's making our lives worse.
So let me turn this a little bit to the marketplace side of this, right? We have talked about the food crisis on this program, not so much about loneliness, but that clearly is an area that we ought to think about the economic impacts of. But let me ask you about the workplace and how people are feeling. I did an interview a number of weeks ago with a young woman named Kyla Scanlon who does TikTok videos about the macroeconomy. And she has coined this phrase called the vibe session, which is to say the economy is lousy in part because people feel so lousy. Do you agree with that?
Well, if you're talking about specifically in the workplace,
yeah,
I do. But this idea about quiet quitting is not new. We find that globally, about 60% of the entire world's workforce is not engaged. But again, this is a problem that's existed far before kind of the past 2 years.
Amen. Let me ask you this. How many people work at Gallup?
1,200 globally.
So do you think 60% of them are unhappy?
No. I was actually referring to the global workforce. So we apply our own sciences to our own organization. And our survey suggests that 90% of our colleagues are thriving at work. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean their overall well-being is thriving, but we work really hard at creating a workplace where everybody has the opportunity to do what they do best and where they can ultimately thrive.
Well, so thank you for that segue to the polling part of the Gallup company. It is, as we said, a busy time for you. Let me frame the question this way. And I'm asking a polling guy, is it possible we know too much about how Americans and people in the world feel?
Absolutely not. We don't know enough because the big data revolution that took place in rich countries has been totally absent in poorer countries. There are 80 countries now in the world that not only don't have a statistics plan, they don't even have it fully funded. So basic data on things like births and deaths just aren't taking place in many poor countries.
I take that point and I appreciate the distinction of the global audience, right? Because that matters. Let me ask you, though, about polling in the United States. There is a surfeit of data about how we feel, what we're thinking, what we're doing, who we like, who we don't like, who we want to vote for, and who we never want to see in office again. Given all of that, do you worry that the insights that polling can give us, which can be substantial, get lost in the noise?
Well, without question, but it's not, I wouldn't blame polling. I would blame the kind of polling. For some reason, in the survey research community, people get really uncomfortable about this kind of survey research about how people feel, how they feel about political issues, and they fail to realize that a lot of the data that they consume is actually collected exactly the same way. So for example, unemployment, it's a household survey of 60,000 people that the government conducts. And they're basically asking over the course of about an hour, do you have a job? What Gallup does differently is, rather than ask, do you have a job, which we do replicate that, but we're also just asking people, how do you feel about the economy? How do you feel about your own personal finances?
I guess my thought on that is more people listening ought to listen to Marketplace because we explain the two surveys that go into unemployment and job gains every single month. But I guess the bigger question, sir, is how do you take the data that you, Gallup, over history has and others with perhaps less sterling reputations in your mind and make leaders pay attention to that when the hurly-burly of political polling distracts everybody and all they can think of is squirrel, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. Sometimes in the research that we're doing, we run the risk of boring our readers because we are...
Sorry to laugh.
I know.
Sorry
to laugh. And it's true. We did an article recently that said Britons are down on their economy. We know that the UK has the highest inflation of all rich countries. Sometimes what we want people to know is that we can confirm conventional wisdom. But other times when we don't, and we tell them something that is quite surprising, like the global rise of pain, worry, and stress, I hope it means that leaders will pay even more attention because they'll see an organization that, you know, kind of stuck to telling exactly what the information was. And when we come up with something like this, it means that they'll pay even more attention to it.
John Clifton is the CEO of Gallup. The book from Mr. Clifton and the good people at Gallup is called Blind Spot, The Global Rise of Unhappiness and How Leaders Missed It. Mr. Clifton, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
we are becoming extinct.
Wait, what? But first, let's do the numbers. I mean, honestly, I don't even know what that story's about. Dow Industrials down 125 today, 0.4%. Closed at 29,134. The NASDAQ rose 26 points, about 0.2%. 10,829. When was the last time you heard me say 10,000? S&P 500 down 7 points, about 0.2%, 36.47 there. The World Bank is forecasting sharply weaker economic growth in East Asia and the Pacific this year because of a slowing economy in China. The lender to developed countries, that's the World Bank, expects growth of 3.2% in the region, which includes China. That is compared to its 5% growth forecast just back in April. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, it was close today on the four handle, huh? 3.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You got to look long and hard to find anything in this economy that's as cheap as it was before the pandemic. 2x4s are getting there, though. Wood, lumber, technically, which saw crazy price spikes over the past couple of years. They were an early indicator, those 2x4s were, of inflation when they started going up. So what do you suppose it means now that they have settled down a bit? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Back in August 2020, James Hendricks took advantage of low mortgage rates to buy a house on a nice big piece of land in the Houston suburbs. It was a bit of a fixer-upper. Well, more than a bit.
It was listed as a handyman special, and that was inaccurate.
It needed more than a handyman to repair extensive termite damage that left floors and door frames caving in. And it needed a lot of wood.
And we noticed that price started increasing and going up and up.
So he put the renovation project on hold and didn't get back to it in earnest until prices finally started easing. Now his contractor is back to work, reinforcing the roof framing with freshly affordable 2x8s. Lumber prices can have a big effect on home construction, says Ken Simonson with the Associated General Contractors of America.
Lumber prices are certainly significant for single-family home building. It's one of the most important ingredients in terms of materials that are used.
But falling lumber prices now are more a symptom of a slowing housing market than an opportunity for builders, says Anibon Basu with Associated Builders and Contractors. He says as supply chain setbacks have eased and materials have become more affordable, financing for builders and buyers has become more expensive.
It's very inconvenient. It's almost as if somebody has been trying to sabotage the U.S. housing market or home building market.
He says new home construction has lagged demand since the housing crisis more than a decade ago. And it will take more than cheap 2x4s to fix that imbalance. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Okay, lumber to farming. Ann Schwagel co-owns and operates Prairie Point Farm in Browns Valley, Minnesota. She is set, as a lot of farmers are, to start harvest soon on her corn and on her soybeans. So we have made her today's installment of our series, My Economy.
It's been an okay year, another year of kind of wild weather. Crops don't love going from cold and wet to very hot and dry. That will affect our yields. I think we'll have some of our crops will see a yield drag on it. For us, the name of the game is kind of spreading out our risk. One of the ways that we're doing that is diversifying our crop rotation. We, in late 2020, planted our first field of a perennial crop called Kernza. It's kind of a cousin of wheat. We also have been experimenting with other winter annual crops. So we're growing winter camelina. It's an oilseed crop, so it's being used in jet fuel and renewable diesel. I'm quite excited about kind of the co-benefits that not only am I doing something that's really climate smart and good for my soil health, there's an incentive in that you can sell, have something to sell at the end too. I know that there are lots of headlines about food prices going up, and it's frustrating as a farmer because I know that I'm not getting wealthy off of those increased food prices. I am both a farmer and a professional and a mom, and I wear lots of different hats. And I love that about my life. But I do see it when I, you know, go grocery shopping for my two kids who are seemingly always hungry. It makes me kind of anxious for what we'll do as once those commodity prices that we're enjoying on the farm side go back down and we'll have a tighter and tighter margin. I've been planting a bigger garden every year as much as I have the bandwidth to take care of. It's something that I take a lot of pride in doing, planting and preserving to help try and kind of keep our regular grocery bill as in check as we can. As much as I can convince a 6 and a 9-year-old to eat more local seasonal ingredients, I'm trying to do that. They're also regular kids too. So it's striking that balance, right? They're like, but can we still get fruit roll-ups? I'm like, yeah, I guess you can still get your fruit roll-ups.
Come on, nothing like a fruit roll-up, right? Ann Schwagel there, Prairie Point Farm in Browns Valley, Minnesota. Hey, listen. Let me know how things are going for you right now, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. There are, as we speak, something less than 36 women's colleges in this country. That's down from about 230 at the peak in the 1950s. A lot of them have merged with other schools or closed or have started accepting men. The most recent of those is Notre Dame of Maryland University, which said earlier this month that it's going to go co-ed starting next fall. There are some obvious ramifications here, social and cultural. But as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, this is, at its core, an economic decision.
Lots of Notre Dame students were at lunch when they learned the school would be accepting men.
Everybody gets this email at the same time, and chaos ensues.
Alexandria Malinowski is a senior.
People are crying, people are upset, people are running to their advisors or their professors, and then they run into their office, and then their professor is also crying.
Standing outside the lunchroom where she got the news, freshman Tatum Kapinpin is wearing a blue Notre Dame sweatshirt, but is willing to put on another one. She's considering transferring to a different women's college.
Or just a school that has been co-ed and has actually, like, has run through it before. Like, I don't want to stay here where it's all going to be like a trial experiment.
Notre Dame was founded by nuns in 1895, specifically to educate women, who were then excluded from many other institutions of higher ed. Today, Notre Dame promises a safe and empowering environment for women, and one that's racially diverse, as senior Aliana Coffey points out.
My mom was surprised. She was like, oh, there's a lot of black people here. I was like, yeah!
About half of the undergraduates are people of color, and 55% receive Pell Grants, which are designed for low-income students. But Coffey's concerned that having male undergrads will undercut the special qualities that a women-only atmosphere is designed to provide.
They'll speak out because they always do. And then that's when the women on campus become uncomfortable. They're like, ooh, maybe I shouldn't go wear this to class. Like, this is a cute fit, but I might get heckled by a man.
Back in 1966, Sister Pat McLaughlin graduated from Notre Dame. She had joined the order that founded the school when she was a junior here and is now chair of the school's board of trustees, which made the decision to go co-ed.
It was hard and there was a sadness, but the facts are undeniable.
The facts are, in the next few years, there will be fewer college-age students, period. Like most schools, Notre Dame depends on tuition as a revenue stream. The college costs about $39,000 a year, and by accepting men, it's expanding its potential market. Rosemont College, just outside of Philadelphia, went co-ed in 2009. Jim Colley is now its interim president.
Had Rosemont College not made that decision, it would likely have had to close its doors.
Colley says the school's enrollment went up following the change, which involved figuring out where the male students would live, what sports to offer, and changing the school's mascot from Rosie the Rose Monster to Rennie the Raven. He said all this upset some alumni.
You just need to go through the process. It's almost like a grieving process.
Because even when a school's transition is successful, something is lost.
We are becoming extinct.
Emerald Archer is executive director of the Women's College Coalition and a professor of political science at Mount St. Mary's University, a women's college in Los Angeles. She says the decision from Notre Dame to accept men
is kind of our bat signal in the sky, right? Really bright, letting us know that women's colleges need federal support.
Archer's advocating for women's colleges to receive a federal designation, similar to the one given to historically black colleges, in order to get priority for certain grants. She says while most women's colleges are private liberal arts schools, 93% of students receive some kind of financial aid. Back at Notre Dame's campus, senior Eliana Coffey says she won't be donating after graduation, but she's glad to be an alumna.
I think in the end it was worth it because of the friendships and connections that I've made with fellow students as well as some faculty and staff and even some of the people who work in the dining hall. Like, I know I wouldn't have those types of relationships had I gone somewhere else. It's just sad.
Like lots of other women's colleges, Notre Dame has had to make the choice between educating women with men or eventually not educating anyone. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. This is going to sound bland, but I promise you, in the mostly genteel world of international finance, it is a smackdown. We have told you, I think, about what's going on in the UK, the, shall we say, displeased market reaction to Prime Minister Liz Truss's budget announcement last week, the pound cratering, British government bond yields spiking. Well, the International Monetary Fund has weighed in. Given elevated inflation pressures in many countries, including the UK, an IMF spokesperson said, we do not recommend large and untargeted fiscal packages at this juncture. Oh. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. It comes to us from the trade publication Mortgage News Daily. Hang on to your hats. 7.08%. That is the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage this week. It has basically doubled since the beginning of the year. A little more than double, actually. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Minton and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.